Group meeting, Sunday, 6th June, 1976.
Yes?
How does one decide which mantra is the most suitable?
The disciple is not supposed to decide which mantra is most suitable. That is the task of the teacher. You see? Who gives the mantra? And if one is truly interested in mantras and can utilize them in the right way, it is most worthwhile studying the Tarasara Upanishad carefully. It's a short Upanishad, and there the teacher is Yajnavalkya himself, who was called the Prince of Yogis. In fact, he was called the God of Yogis. Yoga Ishvara. Ishvara is God. And he is one of the greatest teachers. And the mantra which he expounds quite briefly is the one which goes, Om Namo Narayanaya. You see, there are 8 syllables involved in that. And he just briefly states that each of the syllables corresponds with the great gods and with the profoundest archetypal forces operating throughout the universe. Now, the way to utilize that mantra, that also is pointed out, is to enter into meditation, into the perfectly quiet state, at one the mind with that which each syllable is supposed to represent, and then pronounce the mantra. Then it is a word of power which affects transcendent energies, making them function through your whole psychophysical being. But beware of trying to do that unless one is fully prepared to do it, to withstand that influx of energy. The simplest analogy I can give you is this. You know, our electric bulbs are made to stand a certain voltage. If the voltage is greater than that, you will get one blinding flash of light, true enough. That's the end of the bulb. In the case of the disciple, he is the bulb. So beware. These things, one has to be very intelligent about. Always question, why am I trying to do this? What is the objective? Is it something for my gain, for my pleasure, for my advancement, for my liberation, for my happiness? If it is any one of those things, the utilization of psycho-spiritual energy sooner or later harms you. Sooner or later. You may, of course, never arrive at that period in your life when the effects will precipitate themselves on you. You may die before that. This is why I constantly try to tell people, keep away from religion unless you mean real business where religion is concerned. Don't keep away from all the externals of religion. They are, as the Catholics put it quite nicely, very well indeed, They are the instruments of grace, the preliminary instruments of grace. This is what in the in India we call the niyamas, and in yoga too. The yamas, which deal with the development of the moral characteristics, the virtues, which find their supreme culmination in the Mahayana presentation of the paramitas, the excellences, as they are called, the perfection of charity, the perfection of patience, the perfection of wisdom, and so forth. You see, they become the paramitas. But they start as the simple of practice and development of the moralities. Harmlessness, truthfulness, contentment, austerity, and all the rest of it. Austerity, particularly in this modern world, is very, very much required. No one practices it. All this standard of living is the very opposite of any sort of decent austerity, without which no one can be a decent human being. Then come these niyamas, the instruments of grace. You see? And in these religious observances, certain other aspects are developed and built up. And then we have the postures and the breathing. Now we are beginning to deal with power. And you remember, in these 14 and a half years, if I've said it once, I must have said it nearly 1,000 times. Abjure power until there is the harmony of love and wisdom within oneself. And if there is the harmony of love and wisdom within oneself, some reasonable degree of it, then one will probably not misuse power. For the very simple reason, first and foremost, that one will have become free of selfness, of self-orientation. See, what we call unselfishness in the ordinary way is an opposite to selfishness. If one deliberately attempts to practice unselfishness, there is no escape from the fact that one can practice it only in terms of one's interpretation, one's own understanding of the meaning of unselfishness. Now, that of course is a stage, but there you are still in the dualistic world. There is always the conflict between the selfish urge and the intellect, the cool, cold brain, which is, no, that's being selfish, you do the opposite. But in doing the opposite, it is one part of yourself which is opposing another part of yourself. The self is fighting the self. And in that, there is no true healing. It will certainly save you from being sent to jail, perhaps, or something like that. But it is no true healing. When you go still deeper, go past your interpretations and conceptions, which are usually misconceptions very considerably, not altogether, but very considerably misconceptions, when you go past that and go to the root of the matter, you come up face to face with the awareness of what is your actual mode of awareness. How am I conscious at this living moment of existence, which includes me? Am I conscious of myself as a separate subject, as the subject, the observer, separate from you and all things as the observed object. It is that mode of awareness in terms of self and not self. Now there are no qualities attached to this. This is a mode of awareness, isn't it? It's utterly impersonal. There are no qualities associated with the mode of awareness as such. The qualities come in afterwards when that mode of awareness expresses itself in thought and feeling, speech and action. So this is the root of the whole matter. This is our state of sin. When Roman Catholic theology says that man is born in sin and he is in the sinful state and needs to be redeemed, this is the fundamental meaning, but I am not at all certain whether Roman Catholic theology has ever explained clearly or stated simply that this fundamental state of sinfulness is our own mode of awareness of existence from moment to moment. Thou and I, they are separate things. Therefore, you and I, beyond a certain point, we cannot agree and we blow up in conflict. You see? Now, if you examine that and pay attention to it, be intensely attentive to the mode of awareness, it's very easy to for that mode of awareness from being a right mode in which you are aware of your relationship with your environment and are in tune with your environment. It's very easy for it to be upset by external stimuli. Very easy indeed, see. Now, if you watch that carefully all the time, then you will find that there emerges something which is transcendent. This which is transcendent is not other than what we call selfishness and unselfishness. This other than is an absolute as far as the relative of selfishness and unselfishness is concerned, the duality of selfishness and unselfishness. Now, selfishness or unselfishness represent a functioning of the mind, don't they? They represent a functioning of the mind, selfishness, unselfishness. They represent the actual psychical processes that are taking place in the living organism. These are energies. These are actual energies. They are realities interplaying with each other, disharmoniously interplaying with each other, because they are opposites. They are irreconcilable opposites, as we say. So they represent psychical energy which has gone awry, which has gone wrong in its manifestation, in its working out. See? Now, what happens with pure attentiveness is that that aspect of my own psychical energy which has gone awry undergoes a transformation if the mode of awareness is pure. If I'm aware not in terms of separativeness, of isolatedness, I am I, you are you, something different. I have my own drives, desires, my sensitivities and so forth, and if they get upset then I get angry with you, or there is a flare-up or whatever the thing may be. And thereby the duality of opposite qualities as we normally understand them and call virtues and vices, you completely transcend that duality because you have transformed your own psychical energy, the ill part of your psychical energy, and something transcendent emerges. So you see, what we call selfishness and unselfishness now no longer have any meaning in terms of this. That is why I have said over and over again, The whole story of spiritual development is the story of the transformation, the transmutation of our mode of awareness of existence. Are we aware in terms of self and not self, or are we aware in terms of one total reality? All the theologies of the world glibly talk about the omnipresence of God. If God, or the ultimate, is omnipresent, it means that the total universe is God. And this is what theistic theology doesn't like at all, because, well, I would say simply, they just haven't got the brains. They need mantras. They just haven't got the intelligence to perceive this fact. It's a simple fact, after all. You have followed, at least I trust you have all been able to follow what I've tried to present to you, you see. And once you really understand this, excuse me, once you really understand this, then you have within yourself the means to right the vessel. Your ship of psychophysical existence as it sails in the ocean of samsara. And it tends to go right over. It tends to drown you. You never actually get drowned. Don't be afraid. You'll only get a little water in your lungs, but don't worry about that. It'll all come out again. And it will enable you to go on and on and on. So, this is true forbearance and endurance. Now, you know how in the Kabbalah, in presenting the being of transcendence itself, the one aspect of the 10 different aspects they present is called netzah, lasting endurance. Actually, we should translate it as everlasting endurance. Continues unkillable. If you really know that, what are you going to be afraid of? This, that, and the other may hurt. But then again, on the other hand, this, that, and the other will be far from hurtful. It will be very pleasant too. But neither the one nor the other will kill you. Whereas in duality, if you are caught up in the net of duality, both pleasure and pain can equally kill you. I'm a roof mender, and I get £5 a week, my lordly income. And I'm working hard on the roof, you know, support a wife and 15 children. You see, can't make ends even get up from opposite sides and see each other, leave alone meet, you see. And suddenly, my friend Jimmy Bloggs comes and says, hey, you've won the pool, £600,000. The pleasure of it rolls me off the top of the roof and I'm dead. Pleasure kills me. No nonsense. You see? So, it is this which is the real healing power. This mode of awareness. So in meditation, when Yajnavalkya teaches Bharadvaja this mantra, and he points out what is the preliminary requirement, this tremendous purification of the whole psychophysical organism to stand the influx of transcendent energy into itself, and then let it flow out freely without hindrance at all. See? Then you can use the mantra and you'll know how to use it. Otherwise, don't play with fire. See, after all, when we use these mantras, I have already touched upon the question of for my gain, for my advancement, for making my meditations easier. But look very, very deeply into the subtle hidden motives. This is what we have to discover. It's one of the deep purposes of meditation. When you sit down for meditation in the deliberate manner, which most people do, instead of being meditative all day long, every second of the day, you see, which is pure mindfulness. If you deliberately sit down for meditation, then out of the well of the unconscious, gradually, all your secret desires begin to come up and stand before you. All your frustrations, all the pleasurable experiences which you have stored in your memory and desire to repeat them over and over again. These are all the demons within us. And the most powerful of these memories, either in terms of frustration or in terms of pleasure, are the memories which are associated with the expression of the sexual drive. Because the sexual expression of the living organism, this organism being derived from the animal state, is the one which gives the supreme sensational pleasure. And if that is, as and when that is frustrated, it is the supreme sensational displeasure. This is everybody knows this. So these are the things that are stored up in the well of the unconscious. You see, tied up with this is the question of celibacy. And I'm afraid, as far as I know, which is extremely little, believe me, as far as I know, the religious teachings, as they have come down for the last 6,000 years nearly, anyway, you see, the religious teachings do not explain this sufficiently well. They just give the impression that, oh, if you live the celibate life, then wonderful heavens will open up and marvelous superhuman experiences and powers and all the rest will be yours. But that's not only an idiotic way of presenting it, but it is also a very reprehensible, exploitive way of presenting it. It really is wrong to present the matter that way. It only keeps us at the level of barter of a very unjust type. If I do this, I'm going to get, 50 times more than what I'm doing. Wonderful things, transcendent things for my petty little celibacy. Who the devil am I to demand from transcendence that it shall be revealed unto me and the heavens shall open simply because I repress the sexual drive? You see? So, look carefully. Let the mind be quiet, and all these things will come up by themselves. They will come up out of the personal unconscious, all these vasanas, as they are called in the Sanskrit Brahmanical texts, as all these substrates for rebirth, as they are called in Buddhist terms. Rebirth is a very bad word because it gives us the wrong picture of the thing. Mental impressions which are not fully worked out, the memories which are all stored up, instead of oneself having gone completely past them, they are not substrates for a reincarnation or any such thing, but for another conditioned state. And that conditioned state will emerge in this present life here and now. Always. I mean, watch your mental processes very carefully. Be extremely mindful. And see how all these demons inside us, as well as the angels inside us, they're all inside us. They are not out there. Heaven, hell, and the whole host are inside here. Brain, nerves, and the physical, the 15 billion cells of the body. They will all come up. You have to let them come up, and then it is your opportunity. Look. Look. Completely quietly, completely intensely, an intense looking, without hate, without resentment, without self-pity, without remorse, and all these things, without approval, oh, what a fine fellow I was there, and so on and so forth. All the nonsense, let it be out. What will happen? Your entire psyche, which is at least partly in the ill state, all the illness in that psyche will change. It is as if you may compare the psyche to a vast quantity of water which has lots of muddy patches and lots of dark things floating, which prevent that water from being absolutely pellucid, letting the light through without let or hindrance. See? The psyche is like that. Well, the whole thing will become absolutely pure, clean water. But you just have to look with tremendous intensity and keep on looking. Don't give in. This is where you summon your virya, your energy, your strength, your power. And you use it, remember, without opposing. This is the point. Resist not evil. You just look and you heal the evil. Without opposing, without grasping, because you have pronounced judgment, this is good. My good and evil absolutely vanish in the sphere of the transcendent. There is no evil nor good in transcendence. You find it in all the great religious teachings, in every religion. Even the theistic religions which talk in terms of the everlasting battle against evil. Marguerite Poretti, who was a wonderful Christian mystic, somewhere around the early part of the 14th century, 1310 or somewhere there, she produced that marvelous work, The Mirror of Simple Souls. It's in French. You see, the original is in French. And the wretched church burned her at the stake because she gave out supreme truths which were absolutely beyond the church altogether. She was a contemporary of that wonderful period, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas, Dante, Eckhart, Tauler, what towering names in the spiritual sphere. She said, she wrote, virtues I take leave of you. Well, of course, anybody reading that says, but what? You become unvirtuous. They don't. They just don't know when they criticize life. They don't. They have no sense of what transcendence means, what human perfection means, true humanity means. They don't know it. So they speak in those terms. You find this teaching of beyond good and evil in the oldest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka, for instance, which is the greatest of the universe. Yajnavalkya himself says, when he is instructing his great pupil, devoted pupil and disciple, King Janaka. Janaka was the king of Videha, a great king really. And when he's instructing him, he says, the seer then is like an ocean. He has gone beyond duality. No evil touches him whatsoever. And in the same Upanishad, I think it is in the Brihadaranyaka. If it is not, it will be in the Chandogya, but I think it is Brihadaranyaka. There is the statement, there, meaning in that state of transcendence, of utter purity. A murderer is not a murderer, a thief is not a thief, an adulterer is not an adulterer, etc., etc., etc. Of course, this gave the early Christian theologians, who were very brilliant Sanskrit scholars in the early part of the century and in the last century, who translated this, to show what a backward, primitive people these were. That they said that all you had to do was to have a little piece of knowledge that Brahman is the absolute all, and then you can do just what you please. They didn't realize the meaning of the word knowledge, vidya. Vidya literally in the ordinary way does mean knowledge, ordinary worldly knowledge. But that is its least important aspect. Vidya in the spiritual, in the religious context, means to see so intensely, so completely, so absolutely, that you are what you see. Obviously this doesn't deal with pots and pans and trees and gardens and houses and the House of Commons or any of all that rubbish. It deals with seeing truth. Then you are the truth. See, that's what vidya meant. So when you are at that stage, how do you think you can be in that stage excepting by utter purity? So now it's that sort of pure man who can utilize the mantra rightly. Use it with extraordinary power. In India, when I was there in 1960 and 61, on one occasion, I heard a man intoning some of these mantras. He wasn't, the sort of perfected, holy, liberated one, but he was a very remarkable person. And my goodness, the effect of that intoning was something indescribable. It seemed to utterly purify the whole atmosphere. One was right here, with such completeness and intensity that this world had become transformed into that other world, here and now. So you see the importance of the whole process of purification, which means the process of unselfing. The isolated self-consciousness disappears. Every time I feel annoyed, angry, and so forth, it is the feeling is born of the functioning in terms of isolative self-consciousness. It's the isolatedness. When the isolatedness has disappeared, there is no vested interest in anything whatsoever, worldly or unworldly, religious or irreligious. No vested interest in anything. Because vested interest means I. The I is involved, wanting something for itself. If you understand this, you will then begin to understand the stupendous significance of the teaching of utter desirelessness. This is something which for theistic theology and for theistic theologians is a very difficult point. How can you be utterly desirous? Of course you must desire the good, the perfect. You must desire, long for God and so forth. What are you longing for when you say that you long for God? You are longing for your photogram of God. Or shall I say the little daub you have made on a piece of paper and labeled God? Your mental construct. And is the mental construct of an imperfect, impure mind like mine God? What utter nonsense. You can never make a construct of the perfect, of perfection. You become it. Then there is nowhere to make the construct. There is no material whatsoever to make the construct, the structure. Because a structure, a construct, is something abstracted out of the totality. It is, to that extent, a sinful thing. The book I have written, in that sense, is a sinful thing. It is a separate something. But I trust that it has been written all the time pointing out, don't do this.
Yes. How can an impure mind be mindful? Can an impure mind be mindful? You seem to be working with a tool that's already faulty.
Yes, of course. Of course, of course. But now look, this is where the difference arises between that which concerns mind and that which concerns material objects. You used the best possible word, tool. A tool is a physical object. It is a separate thing. If the tool is faulty, it might be possible to repair it and make it a good tool. You have a penknife, you say, it's got blunt. Well, you can sharpen that same penknife. Certain tools you can't repair. You have to throw that old tool away and replace it with a new tool. Now, in the case of the mind, your own psyche, your own living psyche, there is no replacing it. It can be, and it has to be, purified, perfected. How? By right use. And by right use, I mean rightly directed use. Once you know certain things about being mindful and so forth, and you practice mindfulness, you try to be awake and aware all the time, and you discover all the difficulties and the flaws, but with the discovery of every single difficulty and flaw, you're healing that too. You're making it a marvelous tool. So don't despair. There is not the slightest reason to give up the ghost and say, oh, I'm hopeless, I'll never get anywhere with it.
But as an initial thing,
As
an initial thing, it has to be selfish. The motivation has to be a selfish one.
It's bound
to
be.
You can't get away from that.
You can't. You can't at first. Because we are like that to start with. And what happens if we are earnest with the living of the religious life, is that we discover that indeed we are like that. You take the ordinary man or woman in the world, you know, he or she thinks, oh, she's quite a good person, she's all right, nothing's wrong with me, I don't have to better myself. I'm a fine fellow. Good old Puck, Lord, what fools these mortals be.
There is the desirelessness you spoke of.
Yes.
Is this the key to, I think a lot of us find it very difficult to find what is necessary in living in the society and what is unnecessary for the religious life. And I wondered if the desirelessness is the key. A lot of people say that it's not the things that you have around you, it's more your attitude towards them living in the society.
That's a very good...
I find this really the most difficult part, living in the society and trying to be mindful and see what is necessary and what isn't.
That's an excellent point you have raised. The first tendency for a person is to say, oh, I can't live the religious life under these circumstances. I must find better circumstances. But if you look at the motivation there, it is a self-centered motivation. I must find better circumstances for my development and betterment. You see? That's one of the root sources of the bedevilment of the effort to live the religious life. Now, whatsoever environment you find yourself in at any one moment, you are there because all the forces at play, environmental and from within yourself, your own desire or the appointment you have made or the desire what you wanted to know or see or do, all these forces have played their part to produce you in that environment. At this moment, you are here in this room, in this district, at this time, etc. and so forth, you see. So all these forces are at play. Now, if one remains wide awake, fully attentive, intensely aware of everything as much as lies in your power to be aware of, obviously, of course. You see, if you remain like that, you will find that this power of attentiveness will work in a mysterious way, gradually harmonizing all the forces. What will interfere with the harmonizing of all the forces at play is your own specialized desire formulated by the intellect, which serves the I-ness, the planner. You see, why do the Upanishads talk so often, get rid of sankalpa, planning for oneself, because it is always the very thing that spoils true religiousness. Watch, and you will find that the situation by itself will change. At any rate, you will find that you have not contributed towards the worsening of the situation by your own desire, by your own plans and so forth. Now, when you are intensely watchful in that manner, you will discover strange things happening. Amongst them, this. In the ordinary way, when we first start this, we are merely passively watchful. And we get the conflict in our mind, the hesitation and the indecision. Oh, now, shall I say this, shall I do this, or shall I not? And so forth and so forth. That is because our watchfulness is not so intense that we see with clarity. When the watchfulness becomes really intense, you see with clarity. And in that seeing with clarity, wheresoever physical action itself is needed, it will take place spontaneously and naturally without any hesitation or anything on your part. But I mean, this is a question of time and growth. Despite what some great teachers say about time. You remember, we talked about this some time back, some meetings back, that were this sudden enlightenment which Queening and the Zen people talk of. It is the climactic point of what has accumulated over a period of time. See, it is always the case. Supposing, take a simple analogy, it may sound very trivial, but it is a reasonably good analogy, you see. You have come back home late in the evening and the entire house is in darkness, you see. Well, you come in, you put on the hall, switch on the hall light, or you walk upstairs and turn on the other light and the whole house is... But it's taken time to get upstairs, you see. It's taken time to get upstairs, but the moment you touch the switch, you see, electricity doesn't take as much time as you and I do to get from one place to another. And lo and behold, the whole place is lighted up. So this sudden enlightenment business is like that. And it happens continuously in every sphere. When you were at school and you had a problem in algebra or geometry and you were chewing your pencil, wondering now, oh, I've got it. But you had to chew that blessed pencil off and eat most of the wood before you got it, you see.
There is one thing that happens when one is tumbling and trying to do this, which is obviously, I suppose, because you don't watch properly enough, you get involved in other people's manipulations unaware of this, and all of a sudden you it's not actually your model you've got into, you know?
Yes, I know. But you see, if
more
I...
More than if you were very bright and clever and said, yes. What's he doing? You know?
But look, if I myself am in the really unmuddled condition,
yeah.
You see, nobody else's muddling would fool me.
No.
You see, this is the point. It is because we ourselves have something in us which is slightly prone or considerably prone to that particular trouble or muddlement, that when the situation offers the circumstance for it, I too get into the muddle. You see? But have you sort of really understood this business about the way in which this transcending of the opposites takes place? You don't destroy them. A wonderful example of this is for instance, the Gospels, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. When Mary Magdalene goes and sees Jesus, meets Jesus, she suddenly gets transformed, doesn't she? What has happened? Mary Magdalene, in Commoner Garden parlance, was supposed to be a prostitute. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes, in Commoner Garden parlance. She was supposed to be a prostitute. But when she went into the presence of the Holy One, the prostitution completely vanished. And she was the one who stood by him at the crucifixion. Whereas the hierarchy used their legs very, very swiftly. His very chosen ones used their legs very swiftly and ran away out of fear. She stood by him. And St. John the Beloved stood by him. And the mother of Jesus stood by him. See? Now, what happened? This psychical energy, which misexpressed itself in Mary Magdalene. Let us assume that she was, literally, as put in the written word, she was a prostitute. This psychical energy misexpressed in this manner was the very stuff of her liberation when the transformation took place. You and I, when we are attentive, when we attend to our vice or our wrongdoing, our intense wrongdoing or our misery or whatever it may be, you see, when we attend to it completely, it is just as wonderful a means for complete liberation as our virtue. In fact, often it may prove a more effective means. Medium, I should say, not an actual means, because means has the positive, but medium, this is the condition, the terrible condition. All right, it is passive, you see, it is there. It is the more effective medium for bringing about this realization, because what hurts is really what wakes us up. What is pleasant doesn't wake us up.
I think one of our greatest failings, Feroz, and I certainly speak for myself, we always look towards the and for the spectacular. We are so reluctant to look at the small everyday things in our lives, and those are the very things that teach us, and those are the very things that constitute our being. For myself, I first began noticing this in a very simple way. I've listened to you for so many years, and the way you've always stressed right speech. I use the ordinary Buddhist terminology, right speech or correct speech. And so often when I've wanted to, particularly in circumstances where other people have been concerned, I've said to myself, do I really need to say that? Is my opinion really worth anything? And it has a most restraining influence on one. It starts that way, at least it has for me. And so often I have spoken of these words of the old Lama in Om, because they are so relevant. If you would reform the world, first reform yourselves. This, if you do honestly, and I think the accent is on honest, will leave you no time to criticize your neighbor. Nevertheless, your neighbor will be benefited, just as a man without a candle discerns the light of another.
Yes. The person who is mindful of his speaking goes very, very far indeed. Our faculty of speech is one of the most remarkable faculties we possess, and far and away the most misused faculty, the faculty of speech. You know, I've said this over and over again. If you look into the Brahmajala Sutta, where the five silas are expounded, 16/25 of the printed space is occupied with one sila concerning speech. The other four get only 9/25. So if the enlightened one, the perfected holy one, laid that emphasis upon speech, you can imagine how important it is. Again, after understanding that as the starting point, you look at the Rig Veda, Book 10, Hymn 125, I think, the hymn to the goddess of speech. It's a most extraordinary hymn, if you can penetrate into its meaning. The goddess says that she does everything and brings forth this, that and the other, and she ends up by saying, I bring forth the Father in the highest heaven. Now consider its significance. The word Brahman, the word God, the word Allah, Ahramazda, or any such word, and what those words stand for, the supreme, the ultimate. If you and I didn't have the power of speech, we could never do it. We might sense it, but having sensed it, the expressing of it means that in some way or other, we have touched that transcendence with our own being. The strange part of the story is that in our psychophysical state, once we have named that which we have actually touched, we have also separated it from us. This is what you have to beware of. This is where speech becomes a power in your hands which can shut you out of heaven. But once you really understand the significance and importance of speech, you will find that you will remain silent except when it is necessary and you have to speak. If you are asked to give a lecture somewhere, well, you have to give that lecture there. And that's that, you have to speak there. See? But in all other conversation as such, a simple word or two is quite enough. You don't want to vomit out words. And the bulk of humanity does just that. It's a frightful vomiting process. Quite unnecessary.